evening. I'm Melissa Ivis. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. There was a recent report by the Regional Think Tank Asia Centre that said it had found that hate speech and ultra-nationalist groups in Malaysia have recently been gaining significant influence in the Malaysian online space. Now, what do we need to do now to address this before it exacerbates any further? Joining me on the show tonight is Dr. Nicholas Chan. He's a postdoctoral fellow at the Strategic Defence and Studies Centre at Australian National University. Nicholas is also the co-investigator of a meta research grant in misinformation and polarisation, focusing specifically on viral politics of right-wing populism in Malaysia. Nicholas, thank you so much for joining me on the show. I was hoping, before we get into the issue of social media, that dimension of it, I was hoping to get your begin our conversation by quoting a question you wrote in a recent piece. You asked, if I may quote you, how and if the concept of the far right can be applied to a Muslim majority Southeast Asian country like Malaysia, and how to factor religion into that analysis. And I think it's so important that we get the terminology right. How should we understand far right extremism in a Malaysian context?
I think, well, as academics, we tend to kind of struggle about definitions all the time. I think a very easy way to define far right is to say, like, these are actors that are hostile to liberal notions of democracy, and although not necessarily about elections, a lot of them, they do join elections. I think in the Malaysian context, we can connect them to kind of the global context. There's a lot of, I would say, forces of ethno-religion majoritarianism. So basically, it thinks that the majority should rule and the majority should decide what rights minorities, however defined, should have. And you see that happening in India, in Indonesia, in Hungary, in Poland, in America. And I think to some extent that is happening in Malaysia, although some of these things are not new. We talk about politics, about race and religion for all the time. But what we are seeing right now that's quite new is how these things connect to global discourses about the culture war, in terms of how do you push back against liberalism, especially in the cultural sphere. And there's just more targeted scapegoating of various kinds of minorities because they say that they kind of infringe on the mainstream culture of the country. So I think, other than some of these things are not new in Malaysia, but you can see that a lot of Malaysians are getting more immersed in these debates on the international scales, which makes more of them more susceptible in terms of taking far-right explanations, in terms of explaining their experience of life and politics in general. So I think, yeah, it's sort of a complex thing, but
okay.
That's what
so
I see.
How do periods like general elections, how does that ramp up or heat up the situation? I want to talk about the recent GE50, the 15th general election, and how what your observations were in the way narratives were being played out in the digital public sphere.
I think I just saw a survey in the afternoon that says that Malaysians are one of the most heaviest users of the internet throughout the world. I mean, it's definitely above average. It says that Malaysians usually spend about 9 hours and 4 minutes online on a daily basis. That's above average. About that time, I think about they spend about 3 hours on social media. That's also kind of slightly above the global average. So I think in that sense, that tells you how do people experience politics, because a lot of these time are spent online. And a lot of these time spent online means that you're not spending those time meeting people in real life, not reading a book, and you're having algorithms kind of fed content to you. But however, how does content influence someone vote? That's something that's very hard to say, because we talk about this as kind of the TikTok election. But if we think back about G12 and G13, we still talk about that Pakatan Harapan, if not Pakatan Rakyat, being the one that's more adept at using social media to gain votes. But now it changed because PN, and then suddenly people get surprised. So I'm not taking this lightly. I think there are some very worrying content online. I mean, we see that with the May 13th and stuff. But because we are so individualized in terms of the things we consume, especially on TikTok, because it's kind of fed to you on an individual basis, it's very hard to know what people actually saw and how they use it to think about politics, actually.
Okay.
But does was there an increase in terms of, I know you said it's not new, but was there an increase in terms of of extremist narratives. I mean, I'm just using the hashtag 13 May as an example, but it seems to be there was a lot more racial polarization online during the elections. I'm just wondering whether was there anything alarming and new in these narratives, which Malaysia unfortunately has had to struggle with for a really long time. But were there anything new and worrying, particularly around extremist narratives?
I think optics during general elections is something that has been going on for past couple of elections. I think, at least personally, I've seen it more during elections, and they kind of died out because a lot of money is being spent on during those time. I think in terms of uptick of those narratives, I think TikTok is a bit shocking because we aren't very used to that space, and there's also this kind of general consensus that that's where the young people are, and these are the information they're given on a very bite-sized manner. In terms of Facebook and maybe Instagram or Twitter, because we are more used to this space, and there's a lot of tussle about how to police them, so that's why we are not that sure. Mm. I think what happens online, while it's very important to kind of note those trends, but at the same time, we are also noting a trend in Malaysia where you often had one side of the political divide that really doesn't have a lot of minority representation, and that gets mainstream. And if there's this kind of will to think that some votes really doesn't matter as compared to others, then those narratives get generated online, especially if those spaces are not policed adequately and there's no political will or kind of awareness in terms of thinking that we have to deal with those things. Because some people would kind of reflect the question back. It's like, no, this is just mundane Malaysian politics. You just kind of see it online and you're not used to it. But I would say that's not really true. So that's, I think that's the more comprehensive picture here.
You pointed to a homogenous opposition group. Does that create a trend? Because will it go beyond the 15th general election? Might it spill over now that we have an emboldened, very very powerful, given that what they won, this number of seats they won in the general election, but a homogenous opposition group, might the trend of continuing to polarize and politicize and racialize, might that continue post GE15?
I think Malaysia, in a way, is lucky in a sense there is still some inertia in terms of this idea of if you want to govern, you have to be at least multiracial or multi-ethnic or multicultural. There's this idea that in terms of being inertia, so people try to hold on to it, even if they don't do so in practice. So there's the silver lining there. But at the same time, there's also the question of, because this is just one election, and because of the shifting political alliances, people are really experimenting on a lot of stuff, including experimenting on to what extent can we play the race and religion card, and then we might win that. Because there's always this sense that if you tried it once, it's like, okay, this is not to the extreme. Let's go to the extreme thing. But here's my point. Some people would say, that's fine. If you try it and it doesn't work, then people will moderate. But I don't think that's the case that's happening. The more you try it, first you shift the Overton window. That means the mainstream becomes something that's even more to the right. And the second thing is that even if it doesn't work, you might have side effects. And then we don't know what kind of side effects we might see, right? Violence or even non-violent extremism. And then you radicalize certain parts of the populace that's not so sophisticated. And this is the thing about politics in terms of that's being fed to them. So I think there's a lot of unintended consequences there as people experiment. So that's mm-hmm. that's my sort of contra opinion there.
Okay, so if there might be unintended consequences with the experimentation in the digital space, might there also be unintended consequences if governments or policy makers try to respond to these narratives? I mean, the idea that they might need to respond to limit certain audience exposure to extremist narratives, to ultra-nationalist narratives, might there be unintended consequences there?
I think yes. I think, and in a way, I think that's why right-wing groups, they grow very fast, because they know that if you respond to them, there'll be some backlash and they can grow. And if you don't respond to them, they can grow still because they have the space to do that. And a lot of this kind of counter speech approach operates on the assumption that there's speech A and then I'll throw out speech B and speech B will cancel speech A. But it doesn't really work like that because you sort of have to kind of create a culture, a kind of mainstreaming of this value, and then your speech works better. And that's why experimentation to me has a dark side of it. The more you experiment, the more you push things and then change the mainstream, and the more you kind of the speech you get is working. And then in a way, governance now is also kind of caught in kind of mindset where people still think about it, is this a problem of freedom of speech? Not a lot of people think about whether this is a problem of the privilege of an audience. Just because you have a freedom of speech doesn't mean that you have the privilege of an audience. It's okay that I tell something to my neighbor, but it's another thing that I take out a megaphone and then yell it out to the entire taman. And that's what the internet's doing. And people don't really talk about this. If we talk about it in real life, it sounds very weird because you get a megaphone. But then in the internet, it was like, this is normal. But is it normal? And that's the question I want to ask. Really.
So holding the megaphone is a privilege that we must, you know, exercise with prudence. Can I ask you very quickly, given that this is your field of research, what do you think is missing from the conversations, the discourse that we're having about the rise of hate speech, the rise of extremism, the rise of ultra-nationalist narratives? What's missing, or what do we misunderstand or haven't fully thought through about this field?
I think Phil, is that we focus a lot on speech, focus a lot on content. We want to see like who says the most awful stuff, and then we think like hate speech is like what Kanye West did when he says something that's so awful that you really know it's very upsetting. But I think not a lot of people really focus on in terms of the kind of activism that makes people feel angry all the time online. So a very good example is that in Malaysia, there's a lot of cases where you have nobody's basically charged for things they said on the internet, offending someone, offending a religion. But we don't really go one step behind and say like, who creates those kind of moments of mobilization where the internet basically turned on that one person? And I suspect if you kind of trace this movement backwards, a lot of those actors are actually doing this full time, or at least they do it all the time. There's like, they make people angry, and these are what I call the hatred entrepreneurs. And it's very hard to get those kind of details because social media company doesn't really want to share that kind of detail. Doing research in terms of uncovering that is difficult and sometimes dangerous because these people, maybe they're backed by little players. And at the same time that we often have the different kind of focus. We want to know how to control speech. We don't want to control activism, which is the people who do this full time and create all these kind of moments where we get so angry. So I think that's an oversight that if you ask me.
Did you say hate entrepreneurs? Is that the term that you were referring to? I like that term. It's very descriptive. Nicholas, thank you so much for joining me on the show. It's been a pleasure. This is a topic that we'll come back to over and over again as as we see Malaysia's democracy continue to evolve. We're going to take a very quick break here and Consider This. We will be back with more. Stay tuned. Hi, welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. Let's continue our discussion about the spread and influence of hate-based and ultra-nationalist narratives in the Malaysian digital public sphere. Munira Mustafa is the founder and executive director of Chasa Group, which is a research and analytical consulting firm specializing in security challenges. Munira, thank you so much for joining me on the show. I'm going to cite a report by the Asia Center that was recently released. They said that hate speech and ultra-nationalist groups have recently been gaining significant influence online. I'm wondering whether you think this is limited to the frenzied fever pitch of the general elections, or whether it will continue, whether this is an ongoing and a concerning trend.
It is going to continue, and I think that people seem to treat it as a recent phenomenon, but it really isn't. We're only noticing them for the last 5, 10 years only because they've started to understand how to leverage social media to galvanize, support, and spread, disseminate their propaganda and messaging.
So how do they do that, Munira? Based on your observations, what kind of strategies do they use? How do we identify that they are spreading the hate content?
So what we need to understand how they use social media is pretty much how we should understand how we use social media. We shouldn't treat them as any different from us, but we just need to understand that they are using, immersing themselves in the online environment the same way as we do, but only because we're feeling that separation because we don't really conform to their ideology. So basically what they're doing is that they're leveraging on the features introduced by social media, such as the quote retweet feature, groups, creating secret chats and things like that. And that's how they manage to gain followers. And sometimes it can be surreptitious. They don't always start off very obvious. They start off in small private chat rooms, but once they start to recognize that they're not the only ones who feel that way, they start to feel emboldened. And a lot of this is being also provoked by political actors, political players that subscribe to the same worldview. And when they have platform, when they have audience, it gets a lot more easier to get that kind of momentum going.
So can we talk about what happened during GE15? You wrote a really great article for Global Network on Extremism and Technology. You used the term rage clicks and hate bombs, which I thought was really wonderful. You know, not to undermine the seriousness of the matter, what were your takeaways about the way the events during GE15 and also after GE15 unfolded on social media?
I think a lot of these bad actors, they understand people being very, very visceral and responsive to what they're saying. And that's why they're very deliberate with the messaging. They have no problems with spewing their hate speech because they know the kind of reaction and response they're going to get from their audience. It doesn't matter if people support them or not, but they understand that when they get that momentum going, when they get both supporters and also the dissenters alike, it gets that whole flow of conversation and messaging propelled through the social media because of algorithms. That's why I called it rage clicks, because people just can't help themselves when they see something they either agree or disagree. It doesn't matter. They just want to click it. I mean, we've heard the term clickbait, and that's essentially it. They rely on the very reactionary response. It's human nature.
It's emotive, isn't it? And that's the business model of social media. The algorithm wants you to react to things. Then what then are the policy responses that are available to limit the audience exposure to it? How should policymakers respond to hate-based content and narratives?
So now I think the popular discourse right now is to ban social media platforms such as TikTok. And I'm kind of against that for now, but my position might change, but this depends on what goes on essentially, because I feel that one, it's not healthy to start banning social media apps because it's going to create a kind of downslide that we cannot reverse. So because that's going to impact our freedom of speech, for one thing. And secondly, I think policymakers don't seem to understand that it is not just one particular platform. I mean, like, people don't, like myself, it's a generational thing. Like, I came from the Facebook, Twitter generation, and the younger generation used TikTok. And we have to understand that people are going to change social media as they evolve because it's a very generational thing. People don't always want to use what their parents are using. They want to be different. So what I think the most practical response is, instead of banning, I mean, it has to be a very serious, grievous offense for us to ban something. But if we want to have a serious, practical solution to it, we have to understand how social media reaps from the attention economy. And a lot of it has to do with the way they economize the advertisers. So this is part of the reason why social media companies are so reluctant to clamp down on bad content, because compared to positive content, people want to interact with bad content more. It brings them the kind of attention to advertisers, and it gives more exposure. Audience get exposed to advertisers, and that's where all the money is. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is not just a problem that only Malaysia faces. A lot of other countries are having the same problem. The United States is having a serious, they're having a meeting, I think a congressional hearing or something, to discuss on how to improve their acts, the communication acts. And I think other than US, a lot of other countries are also doing the same, because, and we should also consider the fact that it's not just hate speech, but there's also a lot of information warfare, such as that could impact and sway voters and things like that, elections. It can undermine democracy. So hate speech is one part of it. There's a whole bigger threat landscape out there. So what I think what's practical is that governments, stakeholders, political players need to be able to work together to formulate a policy that still allows people to have that that freedom to be able to speak and engage and criticize and dissent, but without it impacting our well-being as well. So right. A lot of it has to do with the corporate responsibility of the social media platform, and the only way to get them to adhere to the local laws is to legislate certain policies that compel them to do so.
But that's difficult, because these platforms are global. So you'd need laws that are transnational. Talking about these platforms, Munira, how effective are the platforms' efforts in terms of moderating content and filtering? They say that they're doing this, but can we rely on them to do it?
So that also depends on the ownership of the companies. And we've seen how the politics of the ownership impact users. I mean, look at Twitter, look at TikTok, look at Facebook, and who's heading, who's in charge of the boardrooms. And so, I mean, the dictation still goes up to the head. So, which is why as users, I mean, as an ordinary citizen, community member, what we can do is try to be a bit more diligent and disciplined with the way we interact. What communities can do, and that includes NGOs, CSOs, is that try and encourage a better community, media literacy, political education, things like that. And when we talk about education, it's not just about the schooling. We need to understand what exactly are we participating as an individual, as a member of the community, because we're not just single individuals. We're living in a community. And at the policymaker level, there has to be a bit more accountability. But again, this is a lot of it is politics. And again, they see social media as a tool to leverage themselves. So I think that the hard part is trying to get everyone to collaborate mutually and recognize the benefits of having a more positive environment.
Right. I'm wondering, to get your final thoughts on this issue, you know, what is missing? We talked about what policymakers need to focus on, but when we look at the public discourse, what's being considered about hate-based content and narratives and the exploitation of that of ultranationalist groups on social media, what would you consider something that's under-researched, under-reported, misunderstood even?
I think we're not looking at advertisers enough. We look more on politicians, political players, policymakers, and people who use social media. And then we look at the social media companies themselves. But nobody is actually talking about advertisers themselves, the ones who are putting the adverts for the exposure. Now, I think it's interesting that when Elon Musk took over, that a lot of these companies actually show that they do have the autonomy to pull out their product and independence and not put any money in Twitter. So I think this is a very underexplored part where I think policymakers could at least leverage that point and say that if you're not going to compel social media this way, we're going to do something about it, and that's going to affect your bottom line.
Munira, thank you so much for speaking with me. That was Munira Mustafa, Executive Director of Chester Group, wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night.